30 now. All right. Well, here we are. We are live. Hello, everyone, and welcome, Jeff. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Welcome to the dark side, Dan. I think most everybody in the chat knows who I am, but yeah, my name is Jeffrey Drum. I'm the author of a book called The Land of Chem and the host of the Land of Chem YouTube channel. Oh, by the way, I'm glad I checked Instagram this morning because I didn't know that this was going to be live. So I'm glad I looked at that and didn't start off this presentation with an expletive-laden tirade that I had planned for the beginning of the show. So I would have got us both banned off of YouTube for sure.
Oh, just give it. Like, I think it's like
I'll dial it down a little bit for the.
Yeah. Don't worry about it. If you watch me on Joe, I did drop the F bomb more than my fair share of times. That's how that works.
Yeah, yeah, I try to be really careful about that because I know how scrutinizing YouTube is in terms of expletives, specifically during the first 10 minutes. So once we get past that 10-minute mark, we're good to go.
Exactly.
What's up, chat?
All right, how's everybody doing out there today? All right, we've got lots and there's gonna no way we're gonna be able to keep up with all of this, but yeah, hello, hi. It's good to see y'all. And I'm really happy to get you on, Jeff, because you've got an interesting hypothesis, but I haven't been able to. I'm a busy guy, and you've got a lot of videos that fleshes it out. Yeah. And so I figured it would be a lot easier just to have you on and just to kind of lay it out here. So would you care to do so?
I remember that, and I appreciate that. I remember seeing that your only criticism of my work was that I had too much research to look into. And I don't take that as a critique or a criticism. I take that as a sincere compliment.
Yeah.
Because there's a ton of evidence to corroborate the various hypotheses that I've presented regarding the function of the Egyptian pyramids, specifically related to the production of a series of chemicals on an industrial scale. And then today we're also going to talk about my theories on the stone circle systems from across the UK, but now also in Japan, that I've recently been researching, and their connection to lightning and atmospheric nitrates for fertilizer production.
Fertilizer production. That's interesting. So
fertilizers, man.
That's one of the things that I did. You know, I had the very basic gist of your hypothesis there. Of course, you know, it's a chemical, right? But that was one of the things that was kind of intriguing about it, was that it was technology, but it didn't get into the high tech side of things, and it didn't get into like craziness. It was something, you know, it makes sense that they would need. And, go ahead. Where would you like to start with it?
Yeah. So I'm going to start today with a little bit of a different approach, and I'm going to attempt to explain the evolution and the development of this ancient lightning-based technology that gradually evolved into the operation of the Egyptian pyramids themselves from the perspective of the Neolithic civilization that built these structures. So in the UK, we're talking about the Neolithic civilization that built structures like Avebury and Stonehenge. And then in Japan, we're going to be discussing a civilization known as the Jomon, which are sort of the ancient origin civilization of the Japanese people. And this is a civilization that existed from around 14,000 BCE to around 3000 BCE. So it's an incredibly long period of time that this civilization was around before the beginning of the Yaoi period. And the conventional dating on the beginning of sort of modern agricultural development and domestication of animals in Japan. So there's a connection between these two civilizations, not only in Japan, but also in the UK, because they were building stone circle systems that are literally identical. You could take any of the stone circles that I've been researching and presenting from Japan and either pluck them out of the UK and put them into a field in Japan or vice versa, and they're exactly the same. So there has to be a connection between these two civilizations, most likely in a common point of genetic origin, but that's sort of a topic for another discussion. But I've got a big presentation lined out here, and if you want, I can just fire it up. I wanted to ask, do you have any questions for me specifically in regard of things that you'd like for me to cover during the conversation? Because I've done my best to put together sort of a comprehensive overview of all of my research. And, you know, of course, just chime in if you want to, you know, ask me any questions as we go along.
I'll just pop in and ask questions as we go forward.
Cool. So I'm going to start sharing my screen here.
Yep. I'll go ahead and. Hello, everyone in the chat. Sorry, obviously it's hard for me to communicate with you guys at the same time as I'm talking to Jeff, but I do see you there, and I appreciate you here, and thanks for the support, and for the new subscribers, hello and welcome.
Absolutely. So can you see my screen now?
Not yet, but I'm sure it'll pop up here eventually. It did when we were warming up for this. But it's not there yet. Of course, Murphy's up. Oh, there we go.
All right, good. Here we go. All right, so now full screen with the Land of Chem logo.
That's what we got.
Okay, good. Let's roll. All right, so we're going to start from the very beginning. My first trip to Egypt was in 2017. And my first site that I visited during this research expedition is a site called Abu Sir. Are you familiar with Abu Sir?
I've heard of it, but I haven't been to Egypt. So go ahead and explain the sites and stuff. Besides the major ones, the detail. Well, even still, then the details I'm not going to be nearly as familiar with as you are. So,
yeah, no problem. So as you can see here in the distance, this is the Step Pyramid of Saqqara, and Abu Sir is located in between the Step Pyramid and the Giza pyramids to the north. And it's a pyramid complex with three different pyramids, the Pyramid of Sahure, the Pyramid of Nyuserre, and the Pyramid of Neferkare. And the artifact that you're looking at here is at the Pyramid of Nyuserre. And this is a red quartzite carved conduit that leads from the base of the pyramid underneath the black basalt temple floor, and it terminates here into this collection bowl. And the conventional explanation of this artifact is that it was for water drainage. And the first time that I saw this, that explanation, again, coming from conventional archaeology, absolutely did not resonate with me. And we had a very unique experience on my most recent November tour where we were at Sahure and the pyramids of Abu Sir during a private special permission entry during a rainstorm. And it was pouring all over the site. And if somehow maybe a tiny fraction, 1% of that rainwater would have ended up into this channel, it's an absolutely ludicrous proposition that this incredibly sophisticated red quartzite carved conduit, channel, and collection bowl were for rainwater drainage or collection. First of all, you don't collect rainwater. You would just drain it off to the side of the site, or you would drain it back into the Nile River. So that explanation never really sat right with me. And the first time I saw this artifact, I knew that it was for the production of chemicals, or for the collection of chemicals. And this was sort of the impetus and the inspiration for the development of my hypothesis that the Egyptian pyramids were designed to produce chemicals on an industrial scale. Our next stop was the Red Pyramid of Dahshur, where the interior of these chambers are completely covered with chemical staining. And there's an intense smell of chemically pure ammonia coming from the third and final synthesis chamber. So this was really the beginning of my journey and my hypothesis that the Egyptian pyramids were designed to produce a series of chemicals, is this collection bowl.
How big is that bowl? Sorry.
So yeah, no, it's about 2.5 feet wide.
Okay.
So it's a pretty large artifact. But again, for the idea that this is for collecting rainwater really doesn't make any sense. First of all, you're not going to collect rainwater.
And how deep is it too? Sorry.
Yeah. So it's about, the width of the rim and the depth of the basin are about the same.
Okay.
So it's actually pretty deep. And this is a recent photo. The last time that I was here a year ago, this basin was completely filled with sand. Mm-hmm. So recently the basin's been cleaned out and I finally got to see how deep this thing actually is. So it's pretty substantial, but first and foremost, if this was just for rainwater collection, you're not going to go through all the effort of carving this thing out of red quartzite.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, there is some reason for them to harvest rainwater. I mean, it is people have collected rainwater even when they're near rivers to just get something that's not tainted, not dirty. But that would defeat the purpose of that. When you collect rainwater, you collect it without any runoff. That's the whole point. If when you're sitting next to a river, so I would have to agree with you that this doesn't seem like something that would be used to collect rainwater. I could see a drainage system working like that with the pipe, but the barrel at the end, the bucket at the end is doesn't jive with the rainwater thing. So I could see where you're coming from there.
And the interesting part about this is that the inlet to this conduit is literally at the base of the pyramid itself, which is a very unusual location for this strategic rainwater drain off system. Because why would you put it right next to the pyramid if it's trying to, you know, drain rainwater that was collected from all over the site? And we literally saw this entire location getting absolutely pummeled with rain. And again, the proposition that somehow a few drops would have made it into this conduit system is a pretty preposterous idea. So this was really kind of the beginning of my work, that my visit to Abu Sir and this red quartzite collection bowl. Second of all, you don't really need to carve this exquisite red quartzite artifact here. And to me, the more precise and the more articulated these artifacts are, it's an indication of the importance of what was being collected in them. So you wouldn't go through all of this effort to carve a red quartzite collection bowl of this quality if it was just for rainwater drainage. Sure. It would have been a much simpler system.
Yeah, I can go with
that. I have a ton of videos going into, so everybody that's watching, I'm going to drop a ton of episode numbers during this conversation, because there's no way that I can go into an extreme amount of detail in a limited amount of time. Anyone that's watched my previous podcast know that it goes 4 or 5 hours and I don't even break a sweat. So I'm going to be dropping a lot of episode numbers and references. I highly recommend getting a piece of paper and a pencil to write these things down so that you can go back, check out my YouTube channel, and you can watch out all of the research regarding the function of these artifacts and these sites, specifically the implementation of black basalt, which is a material that we use today for thermal insulation and heat storage, which is exactly why they implemented the black basalt at the Pyramid of Nyuserre and also in the Eastern Temple of the Great Pyramid. But I don't want to get too far off a track, but that's episode 121. And then Sunday site visit 48, our special permission access to the Pyramid of Sahure, also has a very sophisticated network of conduits that originally had copper piping. And again, the idea that this is a water drainage or rain drainage system is pretty preposterous. So I came up with the idea that the Egyptian pyramids were designed to produce a series of chemicals. And my intuition led me to envision that the power source of these structures was lightning. But in 2017, I hadn't really put all the pieces together into the physics that would make this work and how these whole systems operated. And it wasn't until 2023 when my wife and I visited the Serpent Temple of Avebury, where I really started to figure out exactly how these systems work and how they are directly connected to lightning. And I want to make one thing clear, that these ancient Neolithic people, the electric current itself is only a tiny fraction of why they were building these systems. It is all about agriculture and fertilizer, as we'll get to here in just a moment. So I talked about my explanation and the mechanisms of operation that went into Avebury on Members Only Channel episode 6, where I propose that these stone circle systems work in conjunction with the telluric currents that flow through the crust of the earth, creating dielectric polarization of the bedrock, which leads to an accumulation of positive charges on the surface of the earth. And there's a lot of research that corroborates the idea that the location of telluric currents are directly connected to locations for lightning strikes. So this is premise number one that I'm going to propose during the conversation, and I'm going to substantiate this with academic research here in just a moment. So that's what this red ring is depicting, is the accumulation of positive charges around the ring of Avebury's central circle. This ring of positive charges on the surface of the earth serve as an attractor for negatively charged lightning strikes. And then an electric current is distributed throughout the system, and the atmospheric nitrates, these atmospheric fertilizers that are created during the chemical reaction in the air that occurs during lightning strikes, are brought down in during the rainfall. They are fed into the nearby rivers, which were also used for irrigation. And generally speaking, the rain that is rich with these fertilizers is brought down into agricultural areas. So these Neolithic people, this civilization across the world that was building these stone circle systems, were attempting to strategically manipulate the location of thunder and lightning storms to bring down fertilizers in the form of atmospheric nitrates to specific areas for the fertilization of not necessarily agriculture, because conventionally speaking, these are hunter-gatherer civilizations, but for the fertilization of the land from which they gathered their crops.
All right. Yeah, that's not good. Go ahead.
Yeah, no. So again, if you want to jump in and ask some questions,
I just I'm curious as to how you would get. Do they have any evidence for like lightning strikes in areas like that and stuff? Because I'm not too sure about. I'm not aware of them being able to attract lightning through negative charges like that. I've never heard that before.
Oh, yeah. So I'm glad you asked, and I'll get to that here in just a moment. So again, these systems are designed to work in conjunction with telluric currents in the Earth's crust, and that causes an accumulation of positive charges on the ground that serve as basically a target for negatively charged cloud-to-ground lightning. So this is a picture of the Serpent Temple complex at Avebury. You can see the main lightning attractor system here in the center. But this is also connected to structures like Silbury Hill, the West Kennet Long Barrow, the Sanctuary, and Longstones Cove. So this is a huge, they call it a serpent temple complex, that is a part of a massive landscape, terrain engineering, and terraforming system that also is directly related to the West Kennet Long Barrow, which is a chemical reactor that was designed for the production of ferrous sulfate. And I go into that in episode 119 regarding ultrasound crystallization in the West Kennet Long Barrow. These systems also work in conjunction with the White Horse Hills of Wiltshire, England, which were designed to actually generate the cumulonimbus thunderstorm clouds from which these lightning discharges occur. That's episode 137. So now let's get into some scientific evidence connecting stone circles and lightning. And I'm going to describe how this ancient Neolithic civilization came up with the idea to create stone circles to bring atmospheric nitrates and lightning. So this is a site called Oshito Ishi Hill in Japan. And my wife and I just spent a month exploring the entire country of Japan to research the stone circle systems across the country, which, like I said, are identical to all of the stone circles across the UK. And you can see this stone here in the center. It's a little melted at the top. And this stone is scarred with lightning cracks and pockmarks. And we had heard that there are profound magnetic fields that surround all of these stones on the top of Oshito Ishi Hill. And these stones are made from andesite, which is a very unique material in that it contains magnetite. So we brought a magnetometer with us to the site, and we tested the magnetic field surrounding these stones. So if you're using a magnetometer, the average magnetic field of the Earth can range anywhere from 20 to 60 microtesla. When we tested the magnetic field around these stones, we would get readings ranging from 200 to 600 microtesla, sometimes even higher. And I haven't presented the Sunday site visit footage from this expedition yet, but it's coming up soon on my YouTube channel, and you get to see us live testing the magnetic field around these stones. Here's another side view of that same stone, and you can see how the top is kind of melted. And all of the stones on the top of this hill are scarred with lightning cracks, pockmarks, and they all display profound magnetic fields that result directly from lightning strikes on the top of this hill. Here's a picture of my lovely wife, Alexa, sitting on one of these stones, just so you can get an idea of the scale of how big these andesite boulders are. Now, let's talk about some of the research. This article comes from Kumamoto University with two professors, Ichimura and Iriguchi, who studied Oshido Ishii Hill. And here they're explaining that this hill is made of volcanic tuff and welded tuff. And these andesite boulders are protruding from the top of the hill. And they corroborate in this article that here, I will quote, the stones are magnetized by thunder lightnings. So Oshido Ishii Hill stones contain abundant magnetite. And the bare stones sticking out of the hill act like lightning rods. The stones have been attacked frequently by thunder and lightning strokes on the hill. And the positive charge of the ground was discharged repeatedly by the negative charge in the sky through large electric currents into those stones. The depressions and cracks on the surfaces are scars from these lightning dischargers. When the stone was attacked by a thunderstroke, and you got to keep in mind, this is a translation from a Japanese article. And in Japan, they use a word called kaminari, which means both thunder and lightning simultaneously. So when it says thunderstroke here, it's really referring to the word kaminari, which also means lightning. So when a stone was attacked by a large lightning stroke, a large magnetic field was generated around the stone due to the electric current, according to Ampere's law. When the heated magnetite was cooled down below the Curie temperature, the directions of magnetization were fixed and magnetic patches were left in the stone. So long story short, this article corroborates my hypothesis that, and this is a natural site, right? So we haven't even got to the development of the actual man-made stone circles yet, but this is a natural geologic feature of a tough hill that has these huge andesite boulders protruding from the top. And again, the magnetization around these stones is directly related to lightning discharges into the stones themselves, creating this fixed magnetization of the magnetite and the magnetic fields, which still persist to today. So now let's go into the mind of Neolithic man. And these people existed for thousands and thousands of years, and that it would have watched, observed, and learned from the forces of nature. So they would have watched these natural formations recurrently being struck by lightning. And they would have realized that during these lightning events, there was also rain. And for some magical reason, the rain during these lightning events really, really had a profound effect on crop growth. And all of the bushes where they harvested berries or the tree nuts or whatever, all of these foliage and plants that they were using for food, they grew really, really well with this magical thunder and lightning rain. So over the generations, they would have watched and studied these naturally occurring events and gradually would have developed the idea that, hey, what if we take these same type of stones and we move them to another location where we like to harvest food? That is the genesis of stone circle building across the globe. And it is specifically for the selective direction of thunder and lightning storms for the production of atmospheric nitrates, which are brought down in the rain to fertilize agricultural areas. So now this is where things get interesting. This idea of these fire-breathing dragons, right? So this is imagery that relates directly to lightning. And they also have dragon and serpent imagery all across the world. Here you can see the Pyramid of Chichen Itza, where the serpent deity Kukulcan descends to the ground during the fall equinox. This is, again, an image of Kukulcan, this plumed serpent, this dragon, which specifically refers to lightning. And this descent of the snake on the Pyramid of Chichen Itza is directly connected to the beginning of their agricultural season. And I will quote here, folklore tells us that on the equinox, Kukulcan descends from the sky to the earth, bringing with him the energy of the sun and the gift of water for planting. It is as though the feathered snake is an umbilical cord that provides nourishment to the land. Its vibration energizes the earth, preparing it for new growth. So even in South America, we have mythology of this fire-breathing dragon, this plumed serpent, which specifically refers to lightning that is directly in conjunction with the beginning of their agricultural season, because when lightning comes, it also brings rain. And during the lightning events, there is a very specific chemical reaction that occurs in the atmosphere called nitrogen fixation, where the nitrogen in the air, in the atmosphere, reacts with oxygen to form nitrates. And those nitrates dissolve into rain. The rain brings the fertilizers down to these agricultural areas for the nourishment of crops. So I'm just going to take a pause there and see if you have any feedback.
I thought you were waiting for the truck to drive by there.
Oh, no.
I heard him in the background there. No, that's it's interesting. I mean, to be fair, it's a bit of a stretch. It's that they would make that kind of observation and be able to put the two and two together and do it. But it's still not outside of the realm of possibility. So, you know, the nitrogen fixation's right. The rock thing, the rocks getting hit by lightning, that's the kind of thing that's like a, how do you put it? Each time that they get smacked, they're going to magnetize more. Like, you're old enough to remember your Nintendo cartridges or your slot cars, and how your contacts always gather dirt like no tomorrow. That's the same thing going on there. As electricity is used on it, it builds up a magnetic type of magnetism of its own. So each time the lightning smacked a rock, it's going to get more likely for that to happen again in the future.
Yeah. So now we're going to talk about the iron oxide veins that spread across the Giza Plateau, which is also directly related to electric current distribution during lightning events. And a lot of people don't know anything about this iron vein network across the Giza Plateau. But to me, everything about this ancient civilization was about studying and learning from the forces of nature. Clearly, they were very, very interested in solar and lunar cycles, this archaeoastrology where they're tracking the sun, they're tracking the moon, they're tracking the planet Venus. This was what was happening at Stonehenge, and I'll get into Stonehenge here in just a minute, which is known colloquially as the Dance of the Giants. And this is because they were tracking the celestial conjunction of the sun, the earth, and the moon, specifically for the coordination of their agricultural season. So I have to view these things from the eyes of a Neolithic person where everything is related to agriculture. Again, even if these are hunter-gatherer people, it makes a lot of sense that if they could understand that there was a special connection between the rain that occurs during these thunder and lightning storm events and the nourishment of the crops, this provides the impetus and the justification for these type of stone circle systems. And that's exactly what we see in the symbols all across Japan and in the construction of these Jomon stone circles. They were taking these exact same type of landscape features. For example, Oshido Ishii Hill, which is a welded tough outcrop that is embedded with these andesite boulders, and they were creating man-made features with the exact same configuration in an attempt to strategically direct these thunder and lightning and rainstorms to different areas. And all across Japan, we have symbolism that connects thunder, lightning, rain, fertilization, and agriculture. And what you can see here is something called a shimanawa, which is this twisted rope. And this is a symbol for a cumulonimbus thunderstorm cloud. These little white things are called shide, and they are symbolic of lightning. And then these bunches that you can see here have a trifold significance connected to fertilization, rain, and agriculture. And of course, there's abundant mythology about the dragons in Japan, which, according to my research, are directly connected to lightning. So this mythology and the symbolism of the gods like Susanoo, which is the thunder and lightning god that is also directly connected to fertilization, this symbolism permeates the ancient mythology across Japan. And then we see these Jomon stone circles, where they were literally flattening tough hillsides and using the exact same types of stones in a similar configuration, a stone circle, and these are directly connected to agricultural areas. So again, by studying and learning from the forces of nature, and by learning from these natural formations that were naturally attracting lightning into the stone, they learned that they could build these systems to direct the forces of nature strategically to specific areas for the fertilization of crops through atmospheric nitrates. So now let's get into some proof that this was actually occurring from episode 116, proof of lightning at ancient stone circles. And I bring to you the Callanace stone circle. And this paper, a geophysical investigation of the Neolithic Callanace landscape, where they discovered a star-shaped magnetic anomaly in the center of the stone circle. And you can see down here at the bottom, these features are interpreted as indicative of past lightning strikes. So this article is from the University of St. Andrews. This is a peer-reviewed published article that made huge waves in the ancient archaeology world not too long ago. Again, investigating these same sorts of magnetic phenomenon that are indicative of lightning strikes literally in the center of this stone circle system. So here's an image of this magnetic anomaly that they discovered in the center of the system. Another close up here. And later on in the article, I'll quote here, "Lightning is well established not to uniformly strike on the landscape. This is mainly because primary and return strokes in both cloud to ground and ground to cloud lightning follow leaders. Lightning thus effectively searches for and locates position of charge buildup," which is what I just described regarding the accumulation of positive charges, "for effective discharge and grounding on the land surface. Persistent features such as trees, stones, or conductive minerals," which we'll get to just a second on the Giza Plateau, "will tend to be struck multiply over time." And then later here at the article, they state that this looks like it may have represented multiple or repeated strikes of high current density on the center of this stone circle. So here we have academic evidence that literally proves that this stone circle was being struck by lightning.
Now, is that when it comes to the landscape, is that kind of is that a pretty flat chunk of ground? Would that be the high point there? I mean, because one strike and then it's going to like we've established. So I'm just curious if the first one would have been just like they put up a big rock and then it lightning rods into that snowball effect, basically.
Yeah, so that's really the point, is that once you get this going, it is something that will recur over and over and over again. And I'll get to the altar stone of Stonehenge here in just a minute, which there's good reason why they brought that thing all the way from Scotland, because it's different than all the rest of the stones at Stonehenge. So yeah, here's a picture of the Callanace stone circle. I also go into my research discussing the function of the stone avenues, but you can see that this is a super flat outcrop on the top of a hill with this massive pillar, standing stone, or obelisk in the center, which literally serves as the lightning rod to discharge the positive charge that has accumulated on the surface of the earth, is discharged during this negative electrostatic discharge from lightning. Some of the current is distributed through the stone avenue. A lot of it goes back into the ground. But again, the electric current is only a small fraction of the impetus and justification for these systems. What they were trying to do was bring the rain, and to bring the rain that had these atmospheric nitrates. Because again, fertilizer is created during a chemical reaction in the atmosphere that occurs during lightning strikes. So in episode 115, I talk about the function of Stonehenge and how the pillar or the central altar stone of Stonehenge is different than all of the rest of the stones. The big stones and the trilithon stones are sarsen stones, which is high silica content sandstone. You also have the blue stones. A lot of them are also andesite, which is an unusual connection between the structures in the UK and the andesite we see used all across Japan. But the central altar stone is micaceous sandstone. It is unique in the rest of all of these stones because it has extremely high content of mica, which is an exceptional material for high voltage operations. It has an extremely high dielectric strength, and it is an extremely good thermal insulator. So it is literally a piece of stone that is geologically engineered, you know, in natural forces, of course, to withstand these type of high voltage electric discharges from lightning.
Okay.
And I go into great detail in episodes like episode 106, explaining more about the dielectric polarization, the accumulation of these positive charges, these negative electrostatic discharges from lightning, etc. Episode 106. So now let's go into some more proof of electric high voltage, electric current distribution on the Giza Plateau. So are you familiar with the iron vein network that covers the Giza Plateau?
I've heard of it, but I haven't done a lot of research into it.
Okay. So we have a lot of chemical analysis data that I've accumulated over the past 4 years from samples that have been taken from inside of the Red Pyramid, from the coating compound on the Red Pyramid, from inside of the Great Pyramid, and from the iron veins that spread across the Giza Plateau. And it turns out that these iron veins contain tons of conductive minerals, which I just mentioned in that research article regarding distribution of electric current for lightning. These veins contain gold, silver, and silicate microspherules. And these silicate microspherules that you can see here are from fulgurites. So do you know what a fulgurite is?
No.
So a fulgurite is essentially fossilized lightning. So when lightning hits sand, for example, that high voltage electric current gets distributed through the sand, and it's going to fuse a lot of those sand particles into a thing called a fulgurite. It's basically like a Lichtenberg figure or one of these branch formations that forms in the ground. And these fulgurites are filled with silica microspherules. So these silicate microspherules have been found in a variety of the chemical analysis data that we've gotten from these iron vein networks across the Giza Plateau, which is a direct indication that these iron veins have been subjected to high voltage electric current distribution from lightning.
That makes sense.
And I've gone through extensive research documentation in Sunday Site Visit 65, episode 132, Sunday Site Visit 66, exploring the entire Giza Plateau and mapping this iron vein network that literally connects all of the structures on the Giza Plateau. The core bedrock of the Great Pyramid is permeated with this iron oxide. So are you familiar with the fact that the pyramids are built on a mound of bedrock?
Oh, yeah.
So I have documented in numerous site visits from special permission access into the subterranean chamber in the Great Pyramid that the bedrock core of both the Great Pyramid and the Central Pyramid are permeated with these iron veins. And these iron mineral deposits that also contain highly conductive minerals like gold and silver stretch across the Giza Plateau, and they literally connect into every single structure. There's veins that connect into the so-called boat pits. There's veins that lead from the core of the Great Pyramid into the satellite pyramids. There's veins that connect the Great Pyramid into all of these adjacent temples. There's a huge vein that runs from the core of the Great Pyramid directly into the Osiris shaft, which I've also documented the huge iron veins that terminate down in this subterranean system. The core of the Central Pyramid is also permeated with this iron mineral deposit, and it also connects into other various structures, leading all the way down the causeway to the Valley Temple and the Sphinx enclosure. And again, these silicate microspherules that we've discovered in the chemical analysis from these iron veins is the direct signature of high voltage electrical transmission through these iron veins, because the Great Pyramid was designed to get struck by lightning. And if we go back to the beginning, that single stone at Oshido Ishii Hill, that is a tiny stone compared to the size of the Great Pyramid. And if that stone can withstand multiple lightning strikes, the Great Pyramid is literally built to do the same thing. And lightning being the power source of the Egyptian pyramids, as I'll describe here in just a second. So now we're going to transition from the Neolithic stone circle building civilization in Japan and the UK, and we're going to move into the function of the Egyptian pyramids from this same sort of perspective of learning from the forces of nature and interpreting that into functional structures that could produce the same result.
One second, before we take off from the network of the iron stuff there.
Yeah,
do those intersect and whatnot? I mean, because I'm wondering how much these intersect. I'm wondering how well researched is this this network? How is it mapped out pretty well and stuff? I mean, when you start talking about it, conducting electricity and stuff, it's a little bit different than what we would see in nature. So I'm just curious as to how well known it is, how mapped out it is, all that sort of thing.
So as far as I know, I'm the only person that has mapped these iron veins. But if you go back and watch any of the episode numbers that I just referred to, the people can see it for themselves. And I've documented on camera both the core of the Great Pyramid and the core of the Central Pyramid, showing these iron veins running through the bedrock core. And I have fully documented in a long series of Sunday site visits all of these iron veins running through the Giza Plateau, including my mapping and tracking of these things. That being said, what's the guy's name? Robert Schock is the only other researcher I know that has even bothered to recognize the fact that there are iron veins on the Giza Plateau. He says that they're basically Lichtenberg figures from a huge solar flare discharge that literally distributed intense electrical current through the bedrock of the Giza Plateau. So we have a relatively similar interpretation of the end result, which is the electric current distribution through this iron network. However, I think it's from recurring lightning strikes on the Great Pyramid, not from a solar flare. And it appears, and has actually been substantiated by our chemical analysis, that they're not actually Lichtenberg figures. They are naturally occurring iron oxide and conductive mineral veins that permeate the bedrock of the Giza Plateau. So we both have recognized the fact that these do exist. He proposes that it's a Lichtenberg figure. So basically, when you have high voltage electric current in a dielectric material, it causes a phenomenon known as dielectric breakdown. And a material that would normally be an electrical insulator will spontaneously transform into a conductor if the dielectric capacity of that material has been exceeded, which allows the current to flow. For example, if you take a piece of wood and you put a high voltage electric current into that piece of wood, you'll see these branch-like formations start to form in the piece of wood, and they're called Lichtenberg figures or dendritic patterns. And this iron vein network is very, very similar to these Lichtenberg-type figures. So that is another direct indication that they are connected to high voltage electric current distribution.
I have to do the math, but off the top of my head, to get that much, I mean, that's limestone for the most part. So to get that much limestone to conduct electric, that's a lot more than one or two lightning strikes, buddy. Off the top of my head, I'm just blown away how much electricity that would take. That's
that's the point. Yeah. And so I was going to say, let me clarify a point. So again, the Great Pyramid is built to be that size for a reason. And I've also presented in a series called The Electric Field Capabilities of the Great Pyramid. The Great Pyramid itself is designed to store that electric field inside of the limestone itself. It's not necessarily to make it a conductor, but the iron veins in the Giza Plateau facilitate the distribution of any electrical current back into the bedrock. And I have a feeling that the casing stones of the Great Pyramid were somewhat like a Faraday cage for the distribution of some of this electric current down the surface of the Great Pyramid.
Okay, I see. Yeah, I know when I looked into the Electric Pyramid, that's like the standard Electric Pyramid hypothesis. I was looking at the conductive ability capabilities of some of the granite beams in there, and I was like, you would have to pour like your standard lightning bolt wouldn't, like at the other end wouldn't give you enough to, at the other end of one of those granite beams wouldn't give you enough to light up your standard 40 watt light bulb. So I'm just like blown away by how much it would take in order to make those. I mean, I could see where Robert Schock's going down this like crazy plasma discharge shit that to me like seems a little off, but
yeah,
like because the amount of electricity, I mean, to turn wood into a conductor, when they do that, they're pouring fucking juice into that. That's not just a little bit. They're dumping power into that. And that's wood, which is, because it'll burn and stuff, all of a sudden the chemical changes start making it conduct a whole lot better as it burns. But
So no, I 100% agree with that. And again, I don't want to sit here and imply that. So stone is not a conductor of electricity. And that's certainly not what I'm intending to apply here. Stone is actually a dielectric material and an electrical insulator. It actually does the exact opposite, where it doesn't conduct electricity unless the voltage has exceeded the dielectric capacity, which again is one of the reasons why the Great Pyramid is built to be the size that it is, because it's intended to store those electric fields for the production of chemicals on the inside. That's why the Great Pyramid has red granite on the inside. Because when you induce an electric field into the quartz in red granite, you have something called the inverse piezoelectric effect. So let me make a statement here.
Okay.
I highly disagree with the proposition that the Great Pyramid has anything to do with the production of electricity. I highly, highly disagree with that. And I also disagree with intuitively with any pyramid researcher that focuses only on the Great Pyramid as if it is somehow independent than all of the rest of them. That is a huge deficiency in the alternative functional pyramid hypotheses that exist, is that all of these researchers focus exclusively on the function of the Great Pyramid as if this one is this magical electrical producing machine and all the other ones are just irrelevant or they're all just tombs. So if your theory cannot evaluate the function of these structures using the same comprehensive umbrella, there is no way that it's accurate to the function of the structure. So my hypothesis uses the umbrella of electric field and chemical manufacturing to address the function of all of the Egyptian pyramids, the Step Pyramid, the Red Pyramid, the Bent Pyramid, the Great Pyramid, Central Pyramid, and Final Pyramids of the Giza Plateau. And it also assesses structures like Newgrange, these passage chamber systems that exist all over the world, which are also very, very primitive chemical reactors, which we'll get to here in just a moment. All that being said, going back to the conversation about these iron veins, the fact that there are these silicate microspheres in these iron veins is direct evidence that there has been high voltage electrical transmission through these mineral deposits.
Yeah, that's there's no question about that. The question would be was whether or not those iron veins were there as a result of the electricity basically turning the limestone into that, or if that was the iron deposits were there and the electricity's just followed it. Because if there's iron veins there were there naturally, of course any lightning that struck that ground is going to hop straight into that iron and follow it wherever it goes. That's
exactly the point. You nailed it right on the head. Those iron veins are naturally occurring, and they're natural mineral deposits in the bedrock, the limestone bedrock of the Giza Plateau. And that is a strategic reason for the selection of the Giza Plateau for the construction of the pyramid complex that is up there today. They knew about that iron vein network. And in the process, so you have to remember that the Giza Plateau was leveled before they ever did any construction on the pyramids themselves. They leveled that bedrock and they stopped at a very specific place that maintained the integrity and connectivity of the iron mineral veins running through the bedrock. They could have easily excavated all that material, but they stopped at a very precise level that allowed the iron oxide permeated core of the Great and Central Pyramids to still exist. And they maintained the connectivity of all of these iron veins running across the Giza Plateau. They did not go any further in the excavation of the leveling of the plateau, which is a direct indication that they knew precisely what they were doing in the selection of the Giza Plateau and the excavation prior to the construction. They knew about these iron veins and they wanted to maintain their connectivity across the Giza Plateau for the distribution of this electric current.
Interesting. All right. So you were saying that there was piezoelectricity in the pyramid?
Yeah. So a lot of the theories about the Great Pyramid talk about piezoelectricity and, you know, somehow the weight of the pyramid pressing down on the granite and the stone creates electricity. That I highly disagree with that statement and that hypothesis. If anything, it's actually the exact opposite. It's something called the inverse piezoelectric property of quartz for the production of ultrasound. And ultrasound is an extremely effective catalyst for driving chemical reactions, which we'll get to here in just a moment. All right, so let's start at the very beginning of building Egyptian pyramids, the Step Pyramid of Saqqara, which I have proposed was for the extraction and pumping of a bedrock methane deposit.
Well, okay. The inverse. Are you going to revisit that inverse piezoelectricity?
Oh yeah. We're going to go back to that.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Carry on. Dude, I know I'm presenting a ton of material in a very, very short amount of time.
No, it's all right. That stuff speaks my language. I understand this stuff pretty well. So, I worked as an electrician for a long time. So, When we start talking about these things, that's where I was like, well, stop. Let's talk about that for a second, because that gets my brain going.
Did you happen to watch that video from the Thunderbolts project?
I watched some of it. I've been a little bit busy since I got back from Texas. I've been just a hair buried, but I can imagine,
man. That's awesome. So that video was made by a guy named Andrew Hall, and I had no idea that they were going to make that video. And Andrew Hall is an electrical engineer, and he also had a career in the design of chemical manufacturing facilities. And he put together a 30-minute comprehensive overview of my work that addresses the telluric currents, lightning, and chemical manufacturing aspects of my hypotheses in one of the most complimentary videos that I've ever seen. And I was completely blown away and extremely honored that he took the time to do that, because I've been a huge proponent of the electric universe theory for quite some time. Mm-hmm. And I was bombarded with emails the morning that video dropped. And, you know, this is a guy who, again, like you are, he was an electrical engineer and he worked in the design of chemical manufacturing plants. So he has the knowledge to critique these type of things. And over the past several months, dude, I've had people, chemists, chemical engineers, physicists, electrical engineers, people that work in the petroleum industry, because we're going to talk about natural gas and crude oil here in just a moment with the applications for ammonia. All of these people with academic and professional qualifications have reached out in support of my work. So there's a lot of evidence to support my hypotheses. And again, one of the main criticisms is like, it's just too much and it's a lot for me to cover even in a 2-hour presentation. So I'm going to do my best to keep it comprehensive, but it seems like you're at least interested in the hypothesis, which is good.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So step pyramid, extracting bedrock methane deposits. So across the Middle East, there were these ancient fire worshiping civilizations, the Persians, the Zoroastrians, even the Oracle at Delphi in Greece is connected to these quote unquote eternal flames, these sacred flames. And all of these ancient religions are also connected to methane seeps. Are you familiar with what a methane seep is?
That's just where it pops out of the ground, right? Like what? Those,
yeah.
Yeah. Correct. Like they had one at Delphi that they hypothesized that might've been what got like the Oracle used to smell the fumes and get all cooked on them. And that's where they'd hallucinate and shit.
Well, yeah, no, I would actually propose that they were taking hallucinogens and then going and watching the fire. And the fire itself was the Oracle. And they watched these flames while they were tripping their faces off. And they somehow, you know, interpreted divinations from the flame talking to them. But yeah, so all of these ancient fire worshiping eternal flame religions are directly connected to methane seeps. And it just so happens that a lot of these methane seeps are naturally ignited by lightning. So there's a sort of a coincidental connection between lightning and methane seeps. So like I was saying, with these Neolithic people, this ancient civilization studying and learning from nature. So they would have noticed these methane seeps and this mysterious fire coming from this magic air, right? And it doesn't take a huge leap in the mind of the ancient shamanistic magic priesthood class of these ancient civilizations that let's somehow design a structure that can capture this magical fire air and we can use it, because fire is a very, very useful tool to an ancient civilization. Thus, the design of the step pyramid. Again, this is just evidence and scholarly articles talking about the connection between these eternal ancient flames and these natural gas seeps all over the world, specifically in the Middle East, because there's tons of natural gas and oil deposits across the Middle East. So this isn't even speculation or a part of my hypothesis. This is literal history that these ancient fire worshiping religions were directly connected to bedrock deposits of methane. So again, in my interpretation and from the mind of the Neolithic civilization, what if we can take this magic fire air and capture it? And then we can use this fire air for making fire in our homes to heat and boil water, for example. Very, very rudimentary applications that would have been the justification for a massive structure that could extract these bedrock methane deposits. Enter episode 125, the function of the step pyramid. And the step pyramid has this huge network of tunnels running below the central rectangular chamber. And I've never heard anybody else talk about this before, but there's a very special type of bedrock in Saqqara that I'll show you here in just a minute. And I'm proposing that the step pyramid of Saqqara was actually designed to introduce water into a bedrock deposit directly below the structure, and the pumping mechanisms that are involved in the components of the step pyramid were designed to increase and reduce pressure to pump out and allow the percolation of that methane gas to release the gas from the methane deposit. So again, here we have the configuration of a modern bedrock methane extraction pump. And here on the right, we have the configuration of the step pyramid. And this here is a picture of the bedrock cap of a methane deposit. And you can see this dark colored material. This is from the ancient agricultural material that is encapsulated in this bedrock. And that's how this methane forms. You're also I want to say you had some background in geology, correct?
No, well, I mean, I read a lot of stuff about archaeology and geology and whatnot, but I don't have a actual background in it, no.
Yeah, so this is actually a picture from a scholarly article where they're investigating this bedrock methane deposit. And this is what the bedrock looks like around these methane deposits. So now, take a look at the bedrock inside of the Step Pyramid. And I have a couple of pictures here showing the color of the bedrock inside the Step Pyramid. And I have spent 2 years living in Egypt and researching all of these structures. I've been in all of the Egyptian pyramids. There is nowhere else around the Egyptian pyramids that has bedrock that is the same color as inside of the Step Pyramid. This structure is literally placed on top of a cap of bedrock that covers up a methane seat.
Interesting.
You can see more of this extremely dark colored bedrock that looks exactly like this. This is just more pictures from inside the tunnels below the Step Pyramid. Incidentally, this is where all the vases were discovered, inside the tunnels below the Step Pyramid. Here's more of that bedrock below the Step Pyramid. All right, so now let's get to the actual function of the structure. This here is the modern entrance into the Step Pyramid. This is said to have been excavated by the Persians, so this component is not an original part of the structure. So what we have here in the center is an original part. All of these tunnels below are original. And this is from a GPR radar scan that was produced by the Latvian scientific mission to Saqqara, where they also discovered all of these underground tunnels. You can see tunnels running up here to the right. And there is a tunnel running from the subterranean part of the main structure toward the southern tomb. So this one is actually connected into the southern tomb at the end of the Step Pyramid complex. And we'll get into the function of these pipes or tubes here in just a minute. So step number one is filling this subterranean methane deposit with water and strategically increasing and decreasing the pressure to release that gas from the deposit. And we just so happen to have the exact components that are required to do that. This is an image of the quote unquote dry moat surrounding the Step Pyramid. And conventional archaeology will tell you that this was, again, that's their nomenclature, that it's a dry moat. It was absolutely not a dry moat. It was a reservoir that was filled with water that was used to introduce water through the shafts that I just showed that lead out here to the east that connect the central chamber and the underground tunnel system directly into the reservoir. Now, these are my ideas that I presented almost 2 years ago regarding the function of the Step Pyramid and the operation of a structure called Gizr el Mudir. And I'll show you in just a minute that all of the mechanisms of operation that I'm about to explain regarding the extraction of methane in the Step Pyramid were recently corroborated in an academic paper entitled the hydraulic press used to build the Step Pyramid. So they also corroborate the idea that this was a water-filled reservoir surrounding the structure. Next, so these shafts here actually connect directly into the reservoir surrounding the structure. The water flows from the reservoir into the subterranean pump system, and the system of 11 shafts here were strategically designed to be raised and lowered so that they could increase and decrease the pressure either altogether or selectively, pumping areas in this subterranean bedrock deposit of methane, pumping water into these areas to increase and decrease pressure. When they lifted the shafts, it would decrease the pressure and allow the methane gas to percolate up and fill the rectangular shaft in the center. And this process would have been repeated, pumping water in and out of this subterranean shaft network again, allowing the methane gas to fill the central rectangular chamber, and then dropping the pumps back down, increasing the water level within the central chamber, pushing the methane gas and pumping it out of the structure. And then the methane gas would have been extracted out of its a pipe leading from the internal chambers. So here, this is actually a modern map showing huge methane and crude oil mining operations in the Western Desert. And you can see that this pipe here actually leads through Saqqara, the location for the Step Pyramid, and into Dahshur, where the Red Pyramid and the Bent Pyramid are located. And here in just a moment, I will show you that there is a modern crude oil and natural gas processing facility right across the street from the Red Pyramid.
Right on.
And the Red Pyramid, I have proposed, was used to produce an aqueous solution of ammonia. And it just so happens that we use ammonia in modern crude oil processing and would have had applications for ancient crude oil processing, specifically regarding the bitumen industry, which we'll get to here in just a moment. So long story short, the Step Pyramid of Saqqara was designed to feed water into the subterranean network of tunnels below the structure. That water fed into the underground bedrock methane deposit, and the system of pumps that I just described were intended to increase and decrease the pressure within the system to release that methane gas and pump it out of the structure. So the Step Pyramid originally wasn't a pyramid at all. It was a single level mastaba, and eventually they added more layers on top, thus creating the Stepped Pyramid and the first true pyramid in Egypt. And there's a number of reasons that this pyramid design was implemented that would also directly apply to the pyramids that came later. First and foremost, encapsulation of pressure. If you have any pressure leaking out of the system, it's not going to be as effective for your pumping operation. Second, reducing environmental contamination. If you're actually pumping out methane gas, you don't want that leaking out into the atmosphere. So adding more layers to the structure and more body of stone surrounding your internal components would have maintained the internal pressure and also would have encapsulated and prevented any environmental contamination, all factors that are directly related to the implementation of the pyramid design in the Red and Bent Pyramids of Dahshur, and specifically when we get to the Giza Plateau. So all that being said, episode 136, I discussed this new paper entitled The Step Pyramid Hydraulic Lift System, where they describe the utilization of a hydraulic lift mechanism inside of the Step Pyramid that was utilized during the construction. And this is the title of the paper, on the possible use of hydraulic force to assist with building the Step Pyramid of Saqqara. So just keep in mind all of the mechanisms of operation that I just described regarding the external reservoir feeding water into the subterranean tunnel system, and that being increased and decreased inside of the structure for the extraction of methane. So in this paper, they describe the function of a structure called Gizr El Mudir, which is known as the Great Enclosure, that's located to the southwest of the Step Pyramid complex. And here you can see the ancient floodplains of the area around the Step Pyramid in Saqqara. And here, again, to the southwest of the Step, this is the Step Pyramid complex. This is the quote unquote dry moat surrounding the structure. And this is the floodplain coming from the Abu Sir Wadi Valley. And this is Gizr El Mudir right here, this huge rectangular enclosure. And they propose in this paper that Gizr El Mudir was actually a huge reservoir for water treatment. Turns out that in episode 86, more than 2 years ago, I proposed the exact same thing regarding the Great Enclosure Gizr El Mudir. And the following slides come from my episode 2 years ago, way before this academic paper was ever published, showing the floodplains from the Nile River. This is the Step Pyramid Complex here. Here in red is the Great Enclosure, and how this structure was used for the purification of water.
And is that basically what the paper says? Is the same
exact thing? Same thing. Yeah. So this is from the paper here, where they're showing the floodplain coming from the Nile River. Okay. And they're describing the function of Gizr el Mudir as a check dam and for a water purification reservoir, which is exactly what I proposed in episode 86, 2 years before this paper ever came out. But that is not the only similarity between what they proposed in this academic peer-reviewed paper and my work. So they go on further to describe here the function of the dry moat and how this is connected to a water treatment facility in Gizr el Mudir. So here it says, together, Gizr el Mudir and the dry moat's inner south section worked as a unified hydraulic system that improves water quality and regulates flow for practical purposes and human needs. So here you can see in their paper how they have this quote unquote dry moat surrounding the step pyramid filled with water, which is exactly what I proposed in episode 125. And here they show those same shafts that I just referenced and explained and how they are connected directly into this great trench or the dry moat. They describe the exact same mechanisms of operation, how these shafts connecting into the external reservoir were used to feed water into the subterranean system for the operation of this hydraulic press mechanism that they propose was utilized in the construction of the step pyramid. So there's two critical details about their hypothesis that have come directly from what I've proposed regarding the original function of the step pyramid. However, these people are conventional academics, and dare they not propose anything about the function of the pyramids other than them being for burials. So they took the safe route and they went with construction instead of function.
Sure. This is one thing that I frequently talk about how, I'm not a believer in ancient high technology. Right. And so I frequently talk about like the value of research such as yours, even if it ends up with an end result that I don't agree with, which of course a lot of people in the chat are saying, well, this is all woo and whatever. But here we are where Jeff has made some observations that end up being borne out by mainstream science a couple of years later. And this is exactly the kind of thing I'm talking about where, you know, it doesn't, just like science doesn't have to be right with all of its hypotheses and all the shit that it throws at the wall, neither do alternate researchers. All you have to do, what needs to happen is the shit needs to be given a fair shake. You listen to it. Like this, I'm saying this for about half of the chat not even that many, but the people that are acting like this is all just silliness and this is all just crap, because some people, I'm sure you've dealt with it before, they feel that way.
Sure.
And this is exactly what I'm talking about. Even if you feel that way, if you just shut the fuck up and listen to what he has to say, you might actually find some stuff in there that you agree
people
with.
People never actually want to listen to the evidence, right? Well, I've presented scientific evidence that corroborates my theory about lightning at stone circles with literal proof that there were lightning discharges into stone circles. Everything that I've just proposed regarding the function of the step pyramid has also been corroborated in an academic research paper where the exact same mechanisms of operation and components were described, except they took the safe route and went with construction instead of function. And I agree. I completely disagree with the idea of lost ancient high technology. I hate that clickbait nomenclature. It drives me crazy. But none of this is high technology. None of what I'm describing is high tech. It is incredibly simple. Physics and chemistry 101. And all of this can be figured out simply by studying and learning from nature. There is nothing about the function of the Egyptian pyramids that cannot be learned by simply studying the forces of nature. That is one of the main hypotheses and statements that I make in my work, that the Egyptian pyramids were designed to operate in conjunction with the forces of nature to create these chemical reactions. And as we move forward, again, I could care less about people's opinion about my research because there's so much academic and scientific verification from people who are actually qualified to do so. Again, chemists, chemical engineers, physicists, people like Andrew Hall from the Thunderbolts Project. Again, go watch that episode. The guy's an electrical engineer and designed chemical manufacturing facilities. So again, you have these armchair, you know, chit chat comment section people who have no qualifications to comment on my research. So I could care less what they're saying.
Oh yeah, that's
so. Nonetheless,
that's a huge part of what my channel's focused on is the optics of this stuff and how people misinterpret. And so I absolutely have to stop and weigh in on that when I see it there because that is my shtick. So carry on, sir.
Oh yeah, yeah. No, it's all good. And again, if people would just take a moment, like you said, your main critique of my work originally was that I had too much research to even try to tackle. And again, I take that as a great compliment because I have over 200 episodes explaining all of the various mechanisms of operation that are involved in the function of these structures. And what I'm presenting here is just a very precursory, kind of superficial overview of my entire body of work and trying to condense, hell, almost 10 years now of research and study into a 2-hour conversation. Yeah. So that's why I'm referencing all of these different specific episodes. So if people are interested in this idea, you can then go check out my YouTube channel. You can get a copy of my book and learn more about the specifics that I've proposed in these actual episodes. So long story short, I described in episode 125 how the quote unquote dry moat, again, this is a conventional term from the archaeologists that study Saqqara. They call this a dry moat. There is no such thing as a dry moat, right? That doesn't even make sense. Yeah. It's a reservoir. Like, what is a dry moat? It's either dry or it's a moat. It can't have both things, right?
Yeah. Real quick, so hit the super chat real fast. People are so brainwashed they can't think outside the box. That's why they're closed anything outside the established theory. That is a fair point. Icramundin's one. Sorry, man. Those of you who watch my channel know that I can't pronounce foreign things at all, but. Yeah, I would agree with that. And I should also say thanks to Rue for the ticket that he purchased a little while ago. But yeah, a dry moat would be a trench, as Abel says. So go ahead, carry on. Sorry about that.
Yeah, no, it's all good. And shout out to all the people in the chat. I mean, you know, generally speaking with me, you either love it or hate it in terms of my work. And if you don't like it, that's fine. It doesn't bother me whatsoever. But again, if we're trying to propose new ideas about the function of the Egyptian pyramids, A, it has to be comprehensive. It has to be able to address the function of all of the structures simultaneously under the same umbrella. And B, it takes some balls to propose new ideas. And that's why a lot of people don't even bother trying to tackle the idea or the concept of the function of the Egyptian pyramids. Clearly, they're not tombs. Everybody knows that already. And the simple fact that the Egyptian Ministry of Antiquities is now doing this search for Khufu project, they've essentially come out and they admitted that the Great Pyramid was never intended for Khufu's burial because now they're looking for the burial in other places on the Giza Plateau. Have you heard about this project?
A tiny bit. I mean, this to me is it's almost a no-brainer that by the time of the Fourth Dynasty, the idea of burying the king in a big fucking beacon that you could see from 20 miles away is absurd. I don't think that anybody would fall for that. They know that, you know, you got 15 minutes before that grave's getting looted. And people will say, well, they had all kinds of guards and shit on the outside of it. It's like every single one of these things got fucking looted, man. All throughout history, all these tombs get looted. Alexander the Great knew to hide his tomb. I don't buy that these immortal god kings were that stupid.
Right. And not to mention the internal configuration of the structure, it is in no way whatsoever intended for people to even go in there. When you look at the design of the Great Pyramid, the only outlet to the outside takes you into the subterranean chamber. Mm. There's no way to even get up to the king's chamber unless you were going to somehow haul the body up through the well shaft, which is completely preposterous. The design of the Red Pyramid and the Bent Pyramid are the exact same. The idea that this is supposedly for people to go inside. People were never intended to go inside of these things. They're industrial chemical reactors. So let me get back on track here. Again, we were talking about the dry moat, not a dry moat. It's a reservoir. I proposed this in episode 125 regarding the function of the step pyramid. It's later been corroborated. This exact same mechanism of operation that I have proposed regarding the extraction of a bedrock methane deposit, they then applied to the construction using this hydraulic lift system, using these shafts that were discovered by the Latvian scientific mission using GPR scan. Turns out I've also proposed the idea of hydraulic lifts previously in episode 107 regarding the network of vertical shafts all across the Giza Plateau. And they missed out on some very, very critical details, specifically the fact that the southern tomb, quote unquote tomb, the container inside of that thing was actually copper lined, which completely falsifies their hypothesis about the quote unquote sarcophagus and plug mechanism that you can see here. I won't go into detail on that. You can check out the episode where I don't debunk their theory, but I talk about the similarities between their theory and mine.
One quick second, Jeff, we got a couple of super chats here. One of them says, awesome. this theory explains the water pump evidence in the Great Pyramid nicely and also explains the hydrogen staining in the Great Gallery, which I assume you're going to get to here in a second.
Oh, yeah.
And the next one here is, I've been a longtime supporter of Land of Chem. His member-only episodes are insane. So far, his theory explains global mountain thunderstorm generation technology has put more work than any PhD.
So, yeah, buddy, who was that?
No Coiner, KNOW Coiner.
Shout out, Coiner. I appreciate the support on the members-only channel. That's awesome.
We got another one here. Jeebus H. Christ, we need people asking questions and testing from all angles. Thanks for both of your contributions.
And I appreciate it.
Yeah, and it is right. Thank you. I mean, when I express skepticism and stuff, a lot of people, I appreciate you coming on. A lot of people get a lot of people expect me to be a regular debunker and just go for the throat. A lot of people expect me to just sit there and nod my head the whole time. Basically, I try to look for the things that are. If we all look for common ground, we'll probably get along a little better. So I'm trying to find things that we can actually work with here. And there are places that I'll probably end up disagreeing when it's all said and done. But so far, what you put together is pretty interesting. So, dunk 'em, Dan. Okay, Solomon, sorry. There are parts I disagree with. And that's okay. I'm not a proponent of the electric universe. As an electrician, I have a lot of problems with the electric universe theory. It would have made my life really difficult. But you got a new member here as well. Thank you, Little Rob, for joining the thing. Sorry, go ahead, Jeff. I'm not trying to stop you.
Oh no, you're good. I'm curious. Kind of, I can't watch the chat while I'm doing this because I'll get sucked into what they're saying and I'll be wanting to fire back and talk about that. And I'll never cover all the stuff that we've intended to cover here. But no, it's all good. So I've also proposed a secondary hypothesis about the function of the step pyramid that would be really applicable to actual dynastic Egyptian civilization, which is that they were using cow manure for the production of biogas, which is also methane. So you could also reapply all of the internal components of the step pyramid for a simple biogas digester for the production of methane gas. And this is something that they still use in rural communities all across the world, where you have a simple rectangular chamber, you fill it with a slurry of water, agricultural material, and cattle manure, and you produce methane gas due to biogas fermentation. It just so happens that there is a western silo, and this is actually the conventional archaeological term, on the western side of the step pyramid that was used for agricultural storage. It's this huge, it's an immense silo with all of these underground chambers and shafts that were conventionally described as an agricultural storage silo. So that also directly connects to this idea of producing biogas using cattle manure. This would also make a lot of sense in terms of dynastic Egyptian iconography, the deification of cattle, for example. If you were using cattle manure for the production of this sacred fire air, it would certainly make a lot of sense that the cow would then become a deified animal within your civilization. And perhaps that led to the repurposing of the Apis bull as a sacred religious icon in the dynastic Egyptian pantheon. Also, the scarab beetle, which is a dung collecting beetle. the conventional explanation of this hieroglyph and this symbol is that this dung collecting beetle is somehow connected to the rising and setting sun, the god Khepri, rebirth and resurrection. That conventional explanation never made sense to me because it is literally a shit collecting beetle. Mm-hmm. How is that connected to rising and setting sun, rebirth and resurrection? It makes absolutely no sense. However, if you look at this from the perspective of ancient methane biogas production, the first step in the process is you got to collect the methane. I mean, you got to collect the cow dung, which is exactly what the scarab beetle does. It is a dung collecting beetle. So there's a direct connection between this iconography and the possible use of the step pyramid for biogas production, also related to methane. But this is an alternative hypothesis that is more connected to dynastic Egyptian civilization, which I'm not 100% on board with the idea that the pyramids were built by the actual dynastic Egyptians.
Well, I got a couple more supers here real fast.
Yeah, go ahead, man.
Little Addy Rock says, as a former electrical computer engineer and current attorney, I love watching Dan's channel. We've come up with many devices from looking at nature. Thank you. Yeah, that's correct. Many things in nature have given us inspiration to do things. And Duke Man says, unimaginable amount of resources it must require to rebuild to build these super complex, massive structures. It makes more sense for them to serve a practical purpose than pure iconography. I can't argue with that. Go ahead. Sorry.
Well, no. So that's a great point, too, is people don't understand how important chemicals are to our modern world. Literally everything we have today is because of the manufacturing of chemicals on an industrial scale during the Industrial Revolution, specifically regarding ammonia for fertilizer, which we'll get to here in just a second. And one of the criticisms of my work, even Andrew Hall in his Thunderbolts thing, he says, you know, it's a very mundane explanation. There's no aliens, there's no laser beams, there's no magical electricity production. We're talking about methane gas for heating and boiling water, all sorts of rudimentary applications, agricultural fertilizers, acids for metallurgy and also for other applications. It's very, very simple. And again, you have to look at it from the perspective of an ancient civilization. You don't need electricity to survive. No. But if you can harness these naturally occurring electric forces for other applications like atmospheric nitrates, fertilizer, rain, et cetera, it certainly would provide a tremendous benefit for your civilization. So there has to be justification to construct massive infrastructure monuments like this. It's a shitload of work to build a pyramid. There has to be a damn good reason that they went through all of this effort to build these things. And chemicals is a very good reason for that. Because again, it is ubiquitous applications for the benefit of the entire civilization.
It's funny. Have you ever watched the third Mad Max movie, Thunderdome?
So I think I saw that maybe on the one of the plane rides. I've done a ton of plane traveling recently, and I think we may have seen that. But I'm familiar with the Mad Max movies.
Yeah, and on that movie, they have Bartertown. It's Tina Turner runs, and the whole town, it's got electricity. It's almost a real city, and the underworld of that is all pig farming, and you're not allowed to kill the pigs. They farm methane. Methane cometh from pig shit, is what. Yeah. It's funny that you bring that up because that is exactly what they're doing in that, and it is same basic idea. So, yes, Dan runs Bartertown. I'm going to turn off all the electricity. The chat's got it right. Yeah, but yeah, that's the methane stuff methane and fertilizers and things. These are where I can get on board with the simple production of things like that. That's not outlandish, and it's not the kind of thing that the ancients wouldn't be able to observe.
I appreciate that. That's good. And again, none of this is lost ancient high technology.
Yeah.
None of what I'm going to propose, even when we get into more sophisticated chemical reactions like the ammonia production in the Red Pyramid, none of it is high tech. It's all very, very simple physics. Manipulating temperature and pressure, things of that nature, is super easy stuff. So let's get on to that. So the Red Pyramid of Dahshur. This is a picture of the modern Haber process, where they use methane and water to produce liquid ammonia. And now I want to make a very, very clear distinction. The ancient chemical manufacturing process was not producing liquid ammonia. It was an aqueous solution of ammonia, which are two very, very different things, and people have a hard time understanding the difference between the two. Liquid ammonia is supercooled ammonia gas. An aqueous solution of ammonia is ammonia gas dissolved into water. So I am proposing that the Red Pyramid of Dahshure was designed to produce an aqueous solution of ammonia. Again, the gas dissolved into water. So here is a picture of the inside of the Red Pyramid. And you can see here on the left, there is all sort of fluid dynamic staining covering the lower portion of this chamber. And there is chemical staining extruding from the walls of the chamber. And there are also very clear flow patterns, as you can see here on the left. It gets very dark and nebulous toward the top of the chamber. And this staining pattern moves from the southern wall of this first primary reactor through the connecting shaft into the second chamber. And we've done a variety of experiments in the Red Pyramid Fluid Dynamics Modeling Experiment series, where we took a container with the same dimensions of the lower portion of the chamber here. We introduced water through the proposed inlet shaft, and it creates this exact same crashing wave pattern in the southeastern and northwestern corners of the structure. And then the water spirals around as it fills up the primary chamber, which is the first mechanism of operation that goes into making this thing work. And my first time inside of the Red Pyramid, I was looking at all this chemical staining coming out of the walls and the intense smell of ammonia inside of the structure. And I knew that this was a chemical reactor. At the time, I didn't understand all the mechanisms of operation that made it work, but I knew that it was for making ammonia. And fast forward, 6 years, we now have chemical analysis. And I've presented this in a three-part series on my channel, Red Pyramid Chemical Analysis, part 1, 2, and 3, where I present the chemical analysis of the staining that is being extruded from the stone. And it's a majority of iron oxide, strontium oxides, also has concentrations of zinc, lead, antimony. And there's also trace elements like thorium in there, which are all in trace concentrations, which is very, very normal percentages for limestone. But this is...
Real quick, Jeff. Sorry, I got a couple more. The guy says, now explain the Mexican pyramids. Obviously, we're not going to be able to do that now, but does any of your hypothesis extend to the Mexican pyramids?
So as I just mentioned, the Pyramid of Chichen Itza
I saw that. Does any of the chemical stuff or anything, does it extend to that as well?
Well, so again, like the Pyramid of Teotihuacan has that proposed river of mercury running below it.
Okay.
Have you heard about that?
I have.
So for me, anytime I hear about mercury, it's all in for processing gold.
Oh, that's fair. That's an interesting hypothesis. Given their culture.
Yeah. So of course, South America and Mexico was a huge gold producing civilization. So it makes a lot of sense to me. I think it's also called the Pyramid of the Sun, which the sun has always been an ancient alchemical symbol for gold. So there's a direct connection between the Pyramid of Teotihuacan, this quote unquote river of mercury, which I don't know if that's ever been actually substantiated or confirmed, but that's sort of the mythology around the structure. But anytime I hear about liquid mercury, it's immediately for gold processing.
All right. Another one here is your theory suggests they knew how to do fracking, something I'm sure they noticed in nature as the Nile would flood, natural gases would increase.
Yeah. Again, studying nature, it's all very, very simple. This was a civilization that their entire existence predicated on fluid dynamics.
Okay, that makes sense.
The knowledge of the Nile River. And they would have known how to use water as the primary mechanism of operation that drives the function of the pyramids. And you'll see in all of my hypothesis involves water because it was so critical to their overall civilization. They would have understand how to use water to the benefit, again, in this case, for the facilitation of chemical reactions. Water is used in everything. In all of my theories, it involves water as the primary driving force of the chemical reactions, which we'll get to here in just a second regarding the function of the Red Pyramid. So again, all the staining coming out of the stone is actually metallic oxide extrusions, and we have chemical analysis data to prove that, that is coming out of the stone. That is a direct result of high temperature and pressure fluctuations inside of the structure. All right, so here's where it gets really interesting, and we connect the modern industrial revolution, the Haber process, and the manufacturing of fertilizers on an industrial scale with ancient chemical manufacturing. So here on the right, this is the configuration of the Red Pyramid of Dahshur. You'll see the northern inlet shaft, primary chamber, connecting shaft, second chamber, connecting shaft, and the third and final synthesis chamber is elevated above the other two. These two are located at ground level. This one is raised up in the air. And if you take a look here on the left, this is the first apparatus designed by Fritz Haber for the manufacture of ammonia on an industrial scale. This is a small scale that was later scaled up for the industrial application, but you'll see here that there's an inlet shaft, first chamber, connecting tubes, second chamber, and then the third and final synthesis chamber is elevated above the other two. Look at the similarity between these two designs. And in my research, I discovered that Fritz Haber was an avid traveler to Egypt. And he was a chemical engineer. And I have an intense suspicion that Fritz Haber may have taken the same expedition that I did down inside of the Red Pyramid, seeing the vaulted chambers being directly related to the manipulation of pressure, which I'll get to here in just a second, smelled the intense smell of ammonia, and perhaps did the same type of reverse engineering that I did when I started writing my book and came up with the modern Haber process for the production of ammonia, because the modern process and the ancient process all use very similar mechanisms of operation. So step number one is introducing methane gas into the primary reactor and filling this chamber with water to the level of the connecting shaft. And what this does is isolate the reaction space within the primary reformer. And methane gas is insoluble in water, which means it will not dissolve in water. So as the water level is raised inside of the chamber, you will be compressing that gas into the tiered upper vault. The higher you get in the chamber, the less volume there is in the chamber. And if you take a gas from volume one and you compress it down to smaller and smaller volume, what happens? The pressure increases, which is a great way to drive chemical reactions. So the water and the methane will react under these high pressure and high temperatures coming from oriented external electric fields from lightning. I won't get into that because it's going to get completely off track, and we'll get more into the lightning and electric field chemistry when I come back to the Great Pyramid, but it's similar mechanisms of operation. So we have a high temperature and high pressure reaction occurring in the upper vault of the primary chamber that produces hydrogen and carbon monoxide. You lower the water, the high temperature and high pressure gases flow through into the second chamber. You raise the water level again. The reaction occurs between the oxygen, nitrogen, hydrogen, and carbon monoxide. It produces hydrogen, nitrogen, water, and carbon dioxide. The carbon dioxide is soluble in water. The carbon dioxide solution is dissolved. Carbon dioxide dissolves into water. Solution is drained. Water is raised again, pushing the nitrogen and hydrogen into the final synthesis chamber, where a similar mechanism, again, raising the water, which involves operation of the northern pump shaft to push all of this water into the upper portion of the chamber. A reaction occurs between nitrogen and hydrogen, producing your ammonia gas. Now, I am running through this explanation, and I'm leaving out a lot of critical details because I don't want to get too deep in the weeds, because I think we're already an hour and a half in.
Yeah, we're about 20 minutes left. So,
yeah, sorry. So there's no way I can cover all of the mechanisms of operation in great detail in this time. So just please understand that it's a lot more detailed than what
you're
I'm
all right. What you've done so far has already been great as far as like fleshing out how a lot of your ideas work, even if it's not doesn't touch every single point of the. I have an idea now of where you're coming from on this stuff, where before it was just like he believes that these things made fertilizer was what I knew in the past. They were chemical power plants. That was all I knew. So this is definitely been enlightening.
Okay, cool. So let me
really quick before I let you jump back into it, I've got a super chat here. I can't remember where I read it, but wasn't there an Arab guy in history who saw glowing light on top of the Giza pyramids or something? Look, sir, pyramid light is the Masons telling us what it used to be. I've never heard of that, but perhaps you have. No,
I've never heard of that either. I mean, there's a bunch of unusual stories about the Great Pyramid, and you know, I'm getting to some research about this pyramid mountain in Japan called Kuramanta that's also associated with these mysterious lights. So now I understand why that is. It's something I don't quite want to reveal publicly yet because I have it coming up on my channel in a huge research episode. But there's a reason that these mysterious lights are spotted around these pyramid structures that are involved with thunderstorms, lightning events, and all that. So there's a reason that explains that. And I'll get to that in my channel soon regarding Mount Kuramanta, which is also connected directly into a stone circle system.
Nice.
So there's a pyramid mountain in Japan that's directly connected to a stone circle system.
It's interesting.
Yeah. Oh, man. The hopefully, by presenting it in this manner, the evolution from stone circles, lightning and atmospheric fertilizers, and the development of the Egyptian pyramids, people can kind of see how once you go down this pathway and you evaluate all of these structures from under the same umbrella, the whole story starts to unravel. And if you use this same perspective and apply it to all of these structures, it's really, really easy to interpret how these things work. So curiously enough, the etymology of our modern word from ammonia directly comes from the word Amon, the Egyptian deity for, drumline, fertilizer. Amon is the deity of fertility. And that is literally where we get our modern word for ammonia, a fertilizer. And you can see here Amon with these big crops growing out of his head. He was literally the deity of fertility, which I believe is an esoteric symbol that was later encoded into the hieroglyphs regarding the fertilizer production that used to occur in this ancient civilization. So that's a pretty interesting connection between some of the deities of ancient Egypt and this ancient chemistry. And I have a whole series where I discuss some of these ancient hieroglyphs and deities and how these could actually be representations of different chemicals. And we've just misunderstood the interpretation and the esoteric symbolism of these hieroglyphs.
Interesting.
So I'm going to skip over the bent pyramid here because I really want to get to the Great Pyramid. So we can talk about that a little bit. Long story short, aqueous ammonia is not the most functional in terms of applying it to crops. You want to turn it into a solid compound fertilizer so that you can store, transfer, and apply that fertilizer. That was the function of the bent pyramid. All you do is take that carbon dioxide solution that was produced in the Red Pyramid, heat it up, release the carbon dioxide. It bubbles up through the ammonia solution. So you're literally using chemical one to transform it into chemical two, into chemical three. All of these structures operate in series. The methane from the step pyramid goes into the Red Pyramid, transforms it into ammonia. The ammonia from the Red Pyramid goes into the bent pyramid. You utilize the byproduct carbon dioxide, percolate it up through the ammonia solution to produce ammonium bicarbonate. We call it urea today. There's a little bit of a chemical difference between the two, but we still use urea today as a nitrogen-based fertilizer. So that's the function of the bent pyramid. I've also proposed on my members-only channel how the bent pyramid may have also been involved in the production of nitric acid. And this is the way that we do it today, is adjacent to your ammonia manufacturing facility, you'll also have a urea and a nitric acid manufacturing facility that uses that ammonia solution. Again, the number one application for all of these chemicals, fertilizers. So in episode 85, Ancient Ammonia Applications, I also talk about the application of ammonia in the crude oil and petroleum industry, specifically used to neutralize acidic components in crude oil. Ammonia is also used to extract copper, nickel, and molybdenum from their ores. So you can use ammonia for copper leach mining, and you can also use it in the crude oil and petroleum industry. Interestingly enough, you know what was a huge industry in the ancient world? Bitumen and shipbuilding. Bitumen was used ubiquitously in the ancient world as a waterproofing material. And the shipbuilding industry would have been an absolutely massive industry where they were using crude oil deposits to make bitumen. And you have to have some sort of compound to neutralize the acidic compounds in that crude oil before you can apply it to a ship. Because if you don't take the acidic compounds out, it's going to end up deteriorating the wood in your boat. Not a good thing. So enter aqueous ammonia, which we currently use today in the crude oil processing manufacturing to neutralize acidic compounds during the oil refining process. So again, shipbuilding in the ancient world, huge industry, right? Again, the justification for the production of these chemicals has to apply to ancient industries. And they built ships all over the ancient world that used bitumen and pitch for waterproofing and sealing these boats. You can use ammonia to remove all of the acidic compounds from the crude oil that is used to produce bitumen. Shipbuilding industry, absolutely massive.
Before you move to the next point really quick, James Galloway says, great job on your recent series on Japan.
Oh, thank you.
And Santiago Castro says, have you heard of the thunderstorm generator? If so, do you think some, if not all, of these ancient structures would share similar functions?
Yes, I have heard about it. Unfortunately, I disagree with a lot of the conclusions. So the thunderstorm generator is a modern machine used to clean exhaust emissions. In my opinion, it's completely unrelated to the function of the Egyptian pyramids. Unfortunately, there are some nomenclature similarities between my work and this thunderstorm generator, which is why I specifically use the term lightning storm generator instead of thunderstorm.
Makes sense.
Because I want to make sure to distinguish my work from that, because there's really no similarities whatsoever between this modern exhaust emission cleaning machine and the ancient chemistry that was occurring inside of the pyramids.
Okay, we got one more real fast. Do you know the timeline when this area became desert and no longer useful for crops? That was around the time of the fifth or the fourth dynasty. It was kind of like by the time of the dynastic Egyptians, the area was becoming a desert.
Yep. So here is actually a great slide that depicts exactly that. So the time period of my research really focuses on the Saharan wet period, which is from 8500 BC to around 5300 BC. So before 8500 BC, the Sahara was a complete desert. But then for some reason, again, this is directly related to the terraforming applications of the Egyptian pyramids, specifically connected to creating these thunderstorms and lightning and rain events, the Upper Eastern Sahara was transformed into a lush area that was prime for agricultural development. And this lasted for around 3,000 years, where this rainfall was just pouring down on the Upper Eastern Sahara. The entire desert was transformed into a lush agricultural area, which is the time period that I believe the Egyptian pyramids were actually in operation. And they were using these ammonia-based fertilizers and the thunderstorm and rainstorm generating capabilities of the structures to aerate this entire area, transforming it into rich farmland. Then around 5300 BC, the rain stopped. The population moved back to around the Nile River, which coincides with the beginning of the dynastic Egyptian civilization around 3500 BC. But the rains did still continue well into the dynastic period, like Dan said, around the third or fourth dynasty. But technically speaking, the Saharan wet period was from around 8500 BC into around 5000 BC. And this is the area that I really focus on in my research.
All right.
Okay, so now back to the Red Pyramid. Or do you got a super chat?
Nope. Just as you asked, good. You got two here. Does your dates take into account the potential discrepancy in chronology regarding dating? The discrepancy in chronology is fairly minimal. If you're talking about the carbon dating, that's only a few hundred years. And the other one we've got here is Randall Carlson is involved in the thunderstorm generator. Very interesting work. My son and myself are trying to reproduce this. Chemistry PhD and PhD electrical computer engineer. Interesting.
Yeah, no, I really like Randall Carlson and I highly respect him and his research. Again, I just want to make a point of clarification that there's really no connection between the actual thunderstorm generator itself and my work regarding ancient chemistry.
Yep.
So here, this is a Google Earth image of Dahshur. And here on the bottom left, you can see the red pyramid. And this is the entrance into Dahshur tourist area. And right here on the right, this is a Calda Petroleum and Apache Oil joint venture crude oil and methane processing facility. They process both crude oils and methane gas at this facility. And it is literally right next door to both the Step Pyramid in Saqqara, just a few miles away, and the Red Pyramid literally next door that I have proposed was used to make ammonia, which also has applications for the crude oil processing industry. So a pretty interesting wink, wink coincidence that they have this crude oil and natural gas facility literally right next to an ammonia producing plant. And we still use ammonia today for the applications that I just described.
Yep. Another thing really quick, just as far as ammonia, as far as ammonia goes, I mean, you know, there's the old rumor that the Romans brushed their teeth with like fermented pea because it creates ammonia, which that's pretty much been debunked by most historians. But the fact of the matter is ammonia is a cleaning agent. So you wouldn't even have to like work hard to find a reason, like things like vinegar, alcohol, ammonia. The ancients, they had use for these things. You know, they would go through a lot of trouble to produce these things. So it's going into the shipbuilding is a very interesting aspect of it. Would explain why they would need a shitload of it. But their royals would want it for for brushing their teeth.
So when we talk about ancient industry and chemistry, Egypt is literally the birthplace of chemistry. It is where the chemical manufacturing industry began, even according to conventional archaeology. The original name for Egypt is Khem, the land of Chem. My book and my YouTube is a play on words for that ancient word because Khem is the etymological root of our modern word for chemistry. Chem, alchemy, and chemistry all have a common origin in the original name for Egypt. And it's the birthplace of paint manufacturing, like Egyptian blue, for example. Egyptian blue was a paint that was utilized across the ancient world, and they would have had to make hundreds and thousands of gallons, like an immense amount of paint, just to paint all of these monuments with this Egyptian blue paint. That in and of itself is evidence of an ancient chemical manufacturing industry. And the interesting thing about Egyptian blue is the consistency and the quality of the chemical compound itself is almost identical across the ancient world. So they had to have a very specific industrial chemical manufacturing process to be able to create this chemically pure and consistent blue paint. Just the paint industry. They also came up with things like cosmetics, pharmaceuticals, etc. So Egypt is literally the birthplace of ancient chemistry. I think the lineage goes back to the function of the Egyptian pyramids, and then it was inherited later by the dynastic Egyptians in small scale industries like pharmaceuticals and cosmetics. Interestingly enough, at the Grand Egyptian Museum, there is a new case of laboratory glass equipment. And there's a small plaque at the bottom of this explaining that inside of the temples, there were laboratories.
Interesting.
So they literally admit that in the temples adjacent to the Egyptian pyramids, they had chemical laboratories where they were using this glassware for ancient alchemy or chemistry.
Huh. We got one guy here, A Little Rock, again, says that he's going to have to subscribe to your channel. You presented a lot of information in this short time, and I'd really like to know more. He has a lot of questions, too many for here and now. So, and
tell me about it.
There's the link is the top link down below. If you haven't, go click on that and subscribe to Jeff's channel here when we're done.
Yeah. The Land of Chem, Instagram, X, thelandofchem.com, and The Land of Chem on YouTube, spelled Chem as in the land of chemistry. So let's jump into the Great Pyramid real quick. Oh, and you know, this may be the last thing that we get to talk about. I have a lot more slides, but you know, if we cover this, that'll be good. Okay. So the Great Pyramid of Giza. Three main chambers that are all connected by the Grand Gallery here. So the northern entrance goes down to the subterranean chamber. You have the well shaft that leads up into the Grand Gallery. And branching off of the Grand Gallery, we have the King's Chamber and the Queen's Chamber. Everybody knows about the configuration of the Great Pyramid. Sure. And again, all of the theories about function of the Egyptian pyramids focus only on the Great Pyramid, but it is just a part of the system, just like all the rest of these things. So I have proposed that these three chambers, the Great Pyramid, I mean, the King's Chamber, the Grand Gallery, Queen's Chamber, are for the manufacturing of a dilute solution of sulfuric acid. And here in just a moment, I will present chemical proof that there was sulfuric acid inside of the Great Pyramid. So the King's Chamber operated as your sulfur furnace, where air was being drawn in through the air shafts into the furnace chamber. There was a reaction between the air and sulfur dioxides that was pulled through the antechamber, which was your acoustic catalyst chamber. Again, we talked about at the beginning of the presentation, the implementation of electric fields from lightning and the activation of the inverse piezoelectric property for the production of ultrasound. The antechamber is almost entirely made of red granite that is filled with quartz. And I'll get into that here in just a moment. The Grand Gallery itself is your absorption tower. And this was a bit of a complicated reaction where the sulfur dioxides dissolved into the water to produce an intermediary solution of sulfurous acid. The sulfur trioxides then dissolved into that sulfurous acid, which very quickly oxidizes into sulfuric acid. So it's a multi-stage chemical reaction. As with a lot of things in chemistry, it doesn't just happen A to B. There's a lot of intermediaries in the process. And I go into great detail about the specific chemical reactions in episode 120. But long story short, these three chambers are your sulfur furnace, your catalyst chamber, your absorption tower, and your extraction chamber is the Queen's Chamber. And I'll get into some evidence here in just a moment that there is actually a shaft that leads out of the Queen's Chamber that has been reported in all of the ancient archaeological reports and also substantiated by a recent 3D Doppler scan of the Great Pyramid. So why were they producing sulfuric acid? Mostly for metallurgy and for leach mining applications. It's also, again, used in petroleum refining and for the manufacture of fertilizer. So again, all very mundane applications, but very, very applicable to the needs of this ancient civilization. So everybody's familiar with the ram pump theory, right? This was John Cadman that proposed that the subterranean chamber here in the Great Pyramid is actually a ram pump. And he proposes that the southern shaft that you can see here leading out of the subterranean chamber is actually the outlet of a pump system below the Great Pyramid. Well, I had a special permission access I presented in Sunday Site Visit 51 where I crawled down in that southern shaft and it is an absolute dead end. There is no outlet coming from the southern shaft in the subterranean chamber. However, I do agree that this subterranean chamber is a pump shaft. However, it wasn't pumping it out through the southern shaft. It was pumping the water up into the internal reaction chambers. And all of the pyramids were surrounded by an external enclosure. That is well documented in the archaeological record. And I propose that these enclosures were actually water-filled reservoirs. The initial stage is water from the reservoir flows down into the subterranean chamber. System of one-way valves here. Your pump is introduced into the subterranean pump that compresses the water into the internal reaction chambers. As the pump reaches the bottom, the water is compressed even higher into the Grand Gallery and into the Queen's Chamber. The weight from the water closes the one-way valve. Then your reaction occurs to produce your sulfur dioxide and sulfur trioxide that dissolve into the water in the Grand Gallery and then it extracted through the Queen's Chamber. Again, this is a very, very abbreviated explanation. And I go into great detail. If anybody wants to subscribe to the channel, I have a series of playlists that have all of my videos compiled for the function of all of these structures. There's a playlist on the Step Pyramid, Red Pyramid, Bent Pyramid, Great Pyramid, Central Pyramid. Also a series for the Sunday site visits where I've been living in Egypt for 2 years. I did a month in England and Ireland and a month in Japan. And all of those Sunday site visits are on-site experiences where we're exploring these ancient sites. So I go into much greater detail describing all of this. This is just a quick explanation of the subterranean pump chamber and how it works to pump water into the upper galleries. Once this pump is activated, The reservoir is no longer needed to flood water into the chamber. It then comes from the aquifer below the Great Pyramid that you can see here, where if you draw your pump out, it pulls more water into the subterranean chamber from below, and then you can continue your pumping operation. So that brings us to you. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Go ahead and finish up with the Queen's Chamber here. I kind of got to call it here before too much longer. I'm sorry.
I knew it, man. But
go ahead. Finish up with the Queen's Chamber. We'll give it a couple more minutes here.
It's all good. And so this is from the recent 3D Doppler radar scan of the Great Pyramid, where they 3D Doppler radar scanned this thing, and they found the existence of all sorts of potential hidden chambers. Specifically, in the title of the paper is Synthetic Aperture Doppler Radar Tomography Detects Undiscovered High-Resolution Internal Structures of the Great Pyramid of Giza. And I've done a number of episodes about this. This image here and here on the right is showing the extraction shaft located below the Queen's Chamber that was used to remove the dilute sulfuric acid from the reaction chamber. And you can see that shaft here in blue. Here's another diagram where they replicated all of the 3D Doppler radar scans into a 2D diagram that also shows the void above the Grand Gallery. Episode 100, I go into sonochemistry and how you can use ultrasound to facilitate chemical reactions. This just shows red granite has quartz. If you induce an electric field in red granite, that will create the inverse piezoelectric effect for the production of ultrasound. That ultrasound can then be used to catalyze chemical reactions. I go into great detail on that and the specific chemical reactions in episode 120, Great Pyramid Ultrasound Catalyst. And this ultrasound catalyst is well documented in chemical engineering processes. The sulfur dioxide gets pulled through the grooves in the antechamber. Here you have the red granite blocks. The production of ultrasound from those, again, electric fields, like we talked about at the beginning, the lightning strikes on the Great Pyramid cause electric field storage in this massive dielectric pyramid structure. The pyramid is literally designed to contain and isolate these electric fields inside of the King's Chamber and antechamber. And I also have some videos discussing recent research that talks about how the Great Pyramid is designed to concentrate electric fields. Great series of episodes. Again, production of ultrasound causes the acoustic catalyzation of sulfur dioxide into sulfur trioxide, goes into the Grand Gallery. This is just describing the sulfurous action acid equation, where sulfur dioxide dissolves into water to produce sulfurous acid. Sulfurous acid will immediately oxidize into sulfuric acid, and then the sulfur trioxides actually dissolve into the sulfuric acid. So it's a complicated chemical reaction. Long story short, you're producing a dilute solution of sulfuric acid inside of the Grand Gallery. This also explains the function of the Great Pyramid Void that I presented in episode 138, which is a heat exchanger. This newly discovered void above the Grand Gallery is a heat exchanger. The dissolution of sulfur oxides into water is a very exothermic chemical reaction, produces an immense amount of heat. And you want to have a mechanism and a component to remove that heat energy from the system. Long story short, you fill this huge void with water and it removes that heat energy from the system in the form of hot water. Episode 138, explaining the function of the Great Pyramid Void. Turns out that they found a mixture of salts inside of the Queen's Chamber and in the Grand Gallery, most specifically calcium sulfate. Calcium sulfate is a direct indication of a reaction between limestone and sulfuric acid that produced a chemically resistant coating compound that covered the walls of the Queen's Chamber and the Grand Gallery. Sulfuric acid is a vitriolic chemical that will cause deterioration of any stone. But you can see here, when you react a block of solid calcium carbonate with dilute sulfuric acid, solid calcium sulfate is produced. The calcium sulfate is insoluble in dilute sulfuric acid, so it stops the reaction. So this layer of calcium sulfate salt, otherwise known as gypsum, was created inside of these chambers during the initial production run, and it protected the internal limestone components of the Great Pyramid from any further deterioration due to this dilute sulfuric acid solution. So there's literal chemical evidence from this calcium sulfate salt that substantiates the hypothesis that there was dilute sulfuric acid being produced inside of the structure. I go into great detail in this in episode 82, chemically resistant coating compounds and calcium sulfate.
Interesting. But yeah, I'm going to have to call it here, Jeff. I'm sorry. I do have to.
It's all good, man. I did the best I could.
No, you're fine. No. I appreciate it. I'm sorry that I have to cut you off there, but I do have other things in the world I got to take care of.
It's all good.
I really appreciate you coming on. It's been great talking to you. And everybody down below, if you haven't, go check out Jeff, if you've been interested in this, or even if you want to just go yell at him, hate clicks, pay the bills too. So feel free to go check out Jeff's channel and check out his other information. And yeah, one of these days we'll have to try it for a part two here.
Part two. We can actually get into the nuts and bolts of your criticism of the hypothesis and my response to any critique, because I'm open to people critiquing it. Yeah. I love it. If anything, it just makes me better at what I do.
Sounds good. All right, I appreciate you coming on, Jeff. Thanks a lot.
All right, later, man. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you. Take care, everyone.